One, two, three. Let's get it! That was better than last week for sure.
All right, then.
Who farted?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Commander Cast Season 9, Episode 2, recorded on January 16th, 2013. This is the weekly EDH/Commander podcast about community, strategy, and technology. Available every week on NTGcast.com, GuideSpeculation.com, and our headquarters at CommanderCast.com. Brought to you free of charge, without advertising or sponsorship, by an awesome staff of volunteers. Andy might be gone, but we're still carrying the mantle. And by that, I mean I was crazy enough to think I could take over his wildly successful legacy. My name is William, aka Blue Ram, and I'm the podcast director and producer. I'm a casual competitive player who likes to optimize his decks, but I don't go all out to get the uber-expensive cards for them, like some people do. I suck at talking good, but I'm here pretty much because I was the only one who wanted to go through the pain of editing the show, so I guess you're stuck with me, for better or worse. Since last week was so decidedly devoid of dick jokes, I'm bringing on a couple of guys who can whip them out with the best of them. Of course, I'm talking about our affiliates at Off Color Cast.
Off Color.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Yeah, this is Cassidy of Off Color Cast fame, I guess. Fame is probably not the right word, but we'll just go with it. I also write for TCGPlayer.com every week, you know, bringing some EDH content. And I'm at writer on the old Twattertron, and that's about it. So Calvin can go into his oft-rehearsed beginning here.
Hey, everybody. This is Calvin, also known as Captain Red Zone, writing the internet. Cassidy can go eat one.
But in addition to Cassidy and Calvin, we were supposed to have Christian, but then he pulled a Doctor Doom on us and sent a robot version named Lewis instead. But then his battery went and exploded, so he couldn't make it either. So you know what? Fuck Lewis. What are you guys doing? Keep him in a closet or something?
Lewis?
I don't know. Yeah, that's Christian's deal. No, he's cool. He's just a fan, and he wrote to us, so we're like, let's get him on the show. And that's pretty much why Christian's like, let's get him on CommanderCast, and it didn't work out. Whatever.
I'll probably have him on later. In a new twist of CommanderCast, I'm going to ask every guest I have what their favorite commander is. Cassidy, go.
Now I guess it's Gisela, Blade of Gold Knight. She's a baller.
Seems pretty solid. Calvin, go ahead.
This one actually was probably the most difficult question in the show notes that I happen to see. Like, I'm dead serious. I have like 12 decks, and I was like, okay, which one's my favorite? And I actually sat down and like lined them up, and I looked, and I was like, you know, I really don't like any of you.
It's like Sophie's Choice, only you're actually trying to figure out which one you want to shoot first.
Right. And then I was like, oh, well, you know what, if that's the case, and like, I just like, you know what the hell, let's just go back to one of the old faithful ones, and I picked Belthor the Defiled.
Alright, that seems pretty solid too. So as always, if you like listening to CommanderCast, go ahead and stop by our website when we put up content Monday through Friday, all from our kick-ass volunteer staff. We have some new writers this season who could really use some feedback, so go ahead and feed them your comments. You're pretty much guaranteed a response. I'm pretty excited to see some of the stuff they're doing, and we're looking forward to seeing your responses to said content. If that's still not enough for you, go ahead and check out our bros at offcolorcast.com, where you'll have more dick jokes than you can handle. Ha! You see what I did there?
Yeah, I see it. I heard it.
Also, remember that we do have a Season 9 contest going on where you can either redo some flavor text, or show off your artistics by drawing a founder portrait of Andy in one of our CommanderCast mascots. Not only that, but we're also looking for a webcomic artist and a puzzle maker for the site. So if you're interested in any of those, link to the details will be in the show notes. That's it for introductions. Next, we're going to have our first post-Andy free-for-all roundtable.
You little lady, you need to learn to sit down and shut the fuck up.
Yeah, STF, baby. Damn. Ugh, all day. Shut the fuck up.
Hello and welcome to the new free-for-all roundtable. This is our first post-Andy one, so it's going to be complete and utter chaos, and it's going to be knife fights all around. I have no control over this shit. But first, I'm going to go ahead and introduce the concept of interesting versus fun versus innovative. You know, every time I hear someone complain that a card's not interesting, I want to straight up punch a hole in the wall. I really do. When people say something's not interesting, what I think they really mean is not innovative. And something that's not innovative isn't fun for them. It's just boring. Oh, blue-green got more draw power. That's not interesting. What am I going to do with that? You know, something that's not necessarily innovative doesn't have to be fun, though. So I get really pissed off when people start talking about things that aren't quote-unquote interesting. And to kind of reinforce that, I'm going to read a quote real quick from Mark Rosewater's latest article when he was previewing Orzhov. "I've learned over the years that if you try to make everyone happy on every card, you end up with a boring game. One that no one hates, but no one loves. The key to making a trading card game is to make sure that everyone loves something, and not worry that they hate something else. And the primary thing that I'm getting with this is that if something is inherently not interesting to you, that's because it wasn't fucking made for you. We just saw Prime Speaker Zagana, which if you haven't seen her by now, she's a 6-cost, 1-1, that says when she enters the battlefield, she comes into play with 1-1 counters equal to the greatest power among creatures you control, and then you draw cards equal to the number of 1-1 counters on her off of that trigger. And I did a street poll called Swagger Shadow on my Twitter account at CommanderCast.com where you can follow us. And a lot of the responses I got was, Shallow, oh, I get to draw cards. Brrr, what are you going to do? She's a dead card as a commander. What am I going to do with this? She relies on too many other things. But my brother, he was actually really excited for this card. As soon as Gatecrash comes out, we're heading to the pre-release, and he's going to play Simic. As soon as he grabs Zagana, he's going to make a deck with her, and he's going to have shit tons of fun with that. But you know what? I'm done ranting. Cassidy, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I can see what you're saying, where, you know, a lot of people always try to think of EDH as something that's intrinsic to how they think of the game, like spirit of the format and all that. So a lot of times with this narrow view, cards will be uninteresting because it doesn't fit into their way of thinking about it. I mean, the Prime Speaker is a good example because you had mentioned the Prime Speaker as being kind of like, a lot of people said they found it shallow, as you put it, or just uninteresting, I think is what you're getting at. And like, I don't really necessarily agree with that, especially in that card, because Simic doesn't have anything a lot like that. You know, it's a Voltron-y kind of in a way that Edric isn't, and, you know, Kraj is kind of combo-y, and Momir Vig is just kind of, you know, good stuff, try-hard type deal. So, I mean, I think she, whatever the hell.
Yeah, that's a she.
I was wrong about Tristani, so I'm just not even going to bother anymore. And I think there's other cards that are less interesting, like the new Ghost Council. I mean, I won't say that it's not interesting at all, but it...
Yeah, it was pretty much made with standard in mind.
Yeah, and it's very similar to the old one. It has like almost the same mechanics, and you know, Niv-Mizzet I didn't find terribly interesting just because it wasn't innovative. You know what I mean? So I guess for me, innovation is really important. Just when it comes to eternal formats, it's like, you know, if it's not better or at least like comparable to something old that you can use, just don't see the point of it most of the time. I don't know.
Now, see, it's interesting that you brought up the new Niv-Mizzet, because I actually had the exact same thought when I first saw the Draco Genius. I looked at him, I saw, oh, the abilities are flipped, this is kind of not interesting to me, it's not really innovative, all they did was flip it, and whatever. And then I started playing a deck built around the Draco Genius. He's not necessarily inspired, but he's actually a lot better than he looks, and he's a ton of fun to play. I actually like him a lot better than the original Firemind, because he lets you draw the cards at will. It's one of those things that, like we were just talking about, it might not necessarily be innovative, and that might not necessarily be interesting, but hell if it isn't a ton of fun to play.
Sure. Yeah, I totally see what you're saying there.
Yeah, like, I wanted to do a quick comparison of, like, of how I view the words fun, interesting, and innovative. Okay?
Yeah.
When I think of cards that are fun, I think that the general term for fun are mechanics that people know or things that they're kind of used to that they enjoy doing. Shut up. like things I think would people would probably count as fun are things like cycling. You know, it's like a mechanic that everybody can bring back at any given time, but everybody kind of understands it and knows it and plays around with it enough to the point where it's just, you know, this is what we have. Like, no one ever seems to complain when cycling comes around because you kind of know what to do with it. When you get creatures that make tokens, you kind of know what to do with those. When you get things that give creatures +1/+1 counters like this legendary creature, you kind of know what to do with that because, you know, it's fun. You know, it's one of the things that Wizards has actually been using over the years, and it's one of the things that they have a tendency to keep bringing back because out of the years that they've been in, this company's been around, they've come to realize these are things that people enjoy because these are fun things that people do.
Right, I think you hit on a very important note on that, is that Wizards is in fact a business. While I actually believe the mantra that they're not doing it to make money, they certainly use the sales margins to rate how well they're doing with their customers. Because at the end of the day, you have to make that paper. And if something's popular enough, then they're obviously going to be doing more of it so they can keep making more and more paper. So I think that if they're making this stuff, then there's obviously some appeal somewhere. And I find that a lot of the people who actually go on the internet have actually seen a ton of these ideas. They see, oh, you can just blink this over and over again, or you can go ahead and do this generic combo. I've seen that a million times before. It's not interesting. But especially for the newer players, which some of these cards are geared towards, there's this whole Timmy moment where, oh my fucking god, I got whatever the fuck it is I just got. I got Platinum Angel. Platinum Angel! Yeah, some of the more experienced players will look at those cards and they'll go, and it's not good, it's overcosted. But again, you're not the target market for this card. Not every card is going to be for you. And just like not every product. We just had Commander's Arsenal a little while ago, where this was geared towards people who wanted to pimp out their decks. Now, they did underproduce this. R&D will admit that much. But this wasn't aimed at every casual Timmy or Johnny who wanted to go in and just buy a Commander product. This was aimed for people who had the monies.
Kind of get back to the Draco Genius, where you mentioned that it was still a pretty fun deck. And what about it made it more fun than playing maybe Nin or something, or just a different deck altogether? Do you think it was more fun because it was the Draco Genius, or you just had fun with that deck despite him? Or
what I was having fun with was the Draco Genius himself. He's my favorite card to play in the deck. But what makes him different from stuff like Nin and the original Firemind? With the original Firemind, well, there's the obvious price tag of you're going to get hated out first thing. But the Firemind is a lot more combo-oriented, where he's one of the key opponents of the combo. You got a lot of windfall and wheel effects, and you just burn the whole table out. With Nin, she's basically a Tim spot removal card, kind of politics kind of girl. With Draco Genius, what I found is that there are a lot of interactions with me drawing cards. Like, he gets the Archmage Ascension running, but he's also a lot more consistent. He's a huge mana dump, so I can just ping some and go pew, 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 pew! And he also has neat interactions with stuff like Chandra Spitfire, which is normally not that good of a card. But every time he pings a creature, she gets +3/+0, and she gets huge fast. I also find that because the deck's a lot more spell-based, and I don't run a lot of cantrips to replace those cards, I'm running out of cards in my hand pretty fast. He's actually real good at refilling, so just the different utilities and interactions he has with all the cards in the deck itself allow those to turn out to be real fun for me.
Oh, okay, so he's kind of almost like, he's just kind of very solid general then, basically, right? He does some things, but you don't need to rely on him, and people aren't going to hate him out because he's good, but he's definitely not the Firemind. So that's interesting. I just didn't know because I never really found him very interesting, and I didn't imagine it to be very fun. I guess I don't really like Simic colors anyways. Maybe that's just me. Or not Simic, is it?
Whoops! Or is it? Hmm? touching on that real quick to close out the free-for-all roundtable, let's go ahead and mention the kind of cards that do appeal to us, because I just went on a small tirade about the Draco Genius and how much I love that card.
Okay, whether you take Tums for Heartburn or whether you take Bums for Bartburn, I guess. That was pretty terrible. We're keeping it, though. It's that time for the Commander Cast Home Version. This week's question: what makes a new card fun or interesting to you? Our boy Team Dream Crush on Twitter said, cheating things into play is always fun for me, like unexpected results. That's all we got. Where are you at, Twitter people? Answer this question so I can read your stupid things. Luckily, the Facebook end has many, many more answers. I think it's because Gudong's post sit there. And he answered it himself. Sorry, Gudongs, we're not saying yours. Alright. Aaron S. says, if the card does something relatively new to Magic, or makes a win strategy of mine even stronger, or if it's green. Pretty good there. Robbie J. says, cards that make me say, huh, that's cool. Patty G. says, any card that makes mono red better. You got my heart there, Patty G. Justin A. B. says, a new or interesting card for me has to be able to impact the game as soon as you play it. If you can scream, boom, headshot, when you play any card, then it doesn't belong in your deck. And we're gonna round things out with our boy Blake L., because Blake is such a wonderful name. I like cards based on their abilities. I also like tribal cards. Night Vale Spectre makes me happy. Now I just need a Grixis, Legendary Spectre, and at least 11 more Spectres to make an EDH deck with. I lied to you. Let's get a bonus one in here. Willie B says, filling in a hole that a previous deck of mine lacked, giving a color something it didn't do before. Pretty good one there. Alright, there we go. You want to be on this here home version? It gets posted on the Twitter, it gets posted on the Facebook. Answer it, be awesome. Especially on Twitter, guys. And you be on it. Later.
A lot of the cards I tend to like tend to be the more functional cards, the more solid guys. Primeval Titan wasn't a card that I got to play around with when he was available, but being able to just a convenient package of big body ramps out, that was pretty fun for me the few times I could play that. A lot of my generals actually fall into this category. Kalia, pretty linear as far as what she does, but a good solid mechanic in dropping the cards. Karad, Dora, Damia, just not necessarily world beaters, but good solid cards in general that serve really good functional purposes.
Me personally, I like cards that, one, I actually like cards that have interesting effects, but I also like cards that don't require way too much of me. Things like Metalcraft require way too much.
So you don't like build around mechanics?
Yeah, well, you know, you can keep most of those. Like, I've got no problem with building around certain mechanics.
No, parasitic mechanics. That's what they're called.
Whichever mechanic that is. It's like, I have no problem with them as long as it's something within a range I'm willing to deal with. Say, for instance, like Battalion. Since it requires, like, three creatures to attack with, it's kind of the, if I have it, it works. But they're actually, you know, most of the creatures are okay, even without the ability. But with Metalcraft, most of those creatures aren't really worth anything. And by the time I get three artifacts, they're requiring, Metalcraft requires me to play with something I probably didn't want to play with in the first place. Oh, you need to have, like, three artifacts. Whereas with this, it doesn't really care as long as it's creatures. And my decks always have creatures. So once I hit that critical mass, unless a Wrath God happens, I can usually hit that number anyway.
Okay, so a guy like Jorgadine's all right by you then, because he's just a good saw guy by himself.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Calvin likes the Boros.
Yeah, my man, Captain Red Zone. Raise that fist in the air, brother.
I'm waiting for Gate Crash to come just so I can go ahead and crack me open some red and white packs and
get a
hold of my, what's that, Foundry Champion?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you like the Foundry Champ?
Yeah, it's all right. It works for me. Like, it's more of the, like, you know, I get value just for playing it, and I actually kind of like the butt breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah, butt breathing's pretty solid. Usually kills my enemies on sight. All right, Cassie, what kind of cards do you like? To close out.
Yeah, I definitely Primeval Titan is definitely one of my favorite cards. So I really like cards that you get value out of, kind of like you were mentioning. But I think mostly I like cards that open new design space, like Bludgeon Brawl I've been really into lately in that Gisela deck. It's really, really stupid when, like, Fran Foundry is equipping itself and basically making double strike a creature attack for a lot.
Now, question. Have you ever played the Latias when a Planeswalker is out and then equipped a Planeswalker to another Planeswalker?
That's too much work, I'd say. I mean, this is aggressive, mostly. Like, that's too much work.
But then you can actually beat people over the head with a Jace.
I've killed people with Sentinel Flute before, so I'm pretty happy with that. Like, I don't really need to beat people with Jace. I mean, you already lose to Jace anyways, right? Mind Sculptor comes down. I don't wanna rub it in the wounds.
So also
Piersteel Paladin too, that's the other card I wanted to mention. But yeah, stuff like that.
This is a question. Would you get a Bludgeon Brawl altered to look like someone grabbing Jace the Mind Sculptor by his feet and smacking somebody else with him?
I would make it look more like some Master of Arms with so many different random artifacts jammed onto him that he looks like a golem almost. That's what I would do.
Planeswalker in one of those fists at least. He's got to beat somebody with somebody.
All right, Cassie, what else were you going to say before I... So...
Also, Piersteel Paladin, how it kind of changes the rules of the game a little bit. Those all go together really well, Bludgeon Brawl and Piersteel Paladin. So stuff like that, you know what I mean? Just either stuff that gives you good value or stuff that does something new, innovative, changes the game in some way. That's the kind of stuff I like.
All right, that about does it for Free For All Roundtable. If you have your own thoughts about what makes it for a good card to set of you, or if you have something that you don't like when you see new cards, go ahead and hit us up in the comments or go ahead and email us. Next up, we're going to be talking about Cassidy's subject about optimal commanders. Is there such a thing? Sorry, I completely forgot about the free-for-all roundtable final word, so we're going to go ahead and take care of that now. Calvin, what's your final word on the subject?
Fun.
Seems pretty good. Cassidy?
This is the fun, innovation, inventiveness thing that we were talking about.
That is a word, sir. That is an entire sentence.
No, I'm just trying to remember what the free-for-all roundtable is. Okay, so I'm going to go with... What? Oh my god, dude. I'm going to go with innovation. That's my word.
And I'm going to go with interesting. So there you go. Completely bullshit answers from all three of us. Now we're going Okay. Now we're going to go back into the strategy segment where Cassie is going to go ahead and talk about optimal commanders.
Oh, yeah, there, I see it. Okay. Yeah, I have the show notes up. Okay, anyways, back to my rant. Okay, so the next segment in the community here, we're going to talk about optimal commander. This actually exists. It was spurred by Gatecrash, honestly, and I can't see why we wouldn't want to talk about Gatecrash. So basically, it was me asking whether Aurelia was better than Gisela to lead my Boros deck, and we talk about it on the Off Color Cast episode coming up, too. So, I mean, like, I really wanted to know, and then it got me thinking, like, is any general actually, like, optimal anyways? Was it pointless because I just like Gisela better, maybe? I don't know. So that's where it originally came from. You know, it's a good question, and I think for me, mostly, there is an optimal commander when it comes to different builds, and maybe within a color, and I think sometimes that there's some generals are just so bad that they're suboptimal on purpose. Really kind of the opinion lately that every general is optimal in his own way, depending on how you want to play it. We were talking about the Prime Speaker, I'm bringing that up again. She's going to be cool for Voltron, big stompy kind of style, whereas if you want to play smaller Voltron or more like, what's the word, tempo-y, you know, I go with Edric, combo is Kraj, you know, so there's like a lot of different things to do with it, and Kraj is going to be better in a combo deck than the Primal Speaker is, or is it? Prime, whatever her name is, Zagana, I think. And so, I mean, that's kind of what I'm talking about when I brought this up. But well, I have more to say later on. I'll let you guys get to it. You're up first, Will. Go ahead.
Fuck! Cassie pretty much said everything I was going to say. But you know what? That's how you know that you're awesome, when you have great minds on the podcast and you just finish each other's sentences and all that. Okay. The only
finish your sentences before you even got a chance to say it.
Finish each other's sandwiches.
Pretty much. When I started playing, and even to this day, I have a friend named Tyler, and anytime I start discussing a deck idea with him, he's always telling me that if I want to do it, I use General X instead of the one I was talking about. My first deck was Rift the Awakener, and it was a Naya Tokens deck. So then the first time we sit down to play a game, the first thing he tells me is, if you're doing Naya Tokens, use Hazezan Tamar. Hand to face now. If I'm using fun artifacts in Esper, you don't use Sentry, but use Shroom. After the Rift, but before I started playing regularly with this playgroup, I had the Kalia precon, and I was excited to play Tario because she was an angel and I couldn't really grasp what Kalia did at the time. And he said, no, you have to use Kalia for this deck. I mean, that ended up being the right choice in hindsight, but at the time, I wanted to play Tario, but he couldn't really help but tell me that, no, if you're doing this, this is the optimal commander. But I think what the real question here is going to be is, which creature does what best? Like, you're talking about different builds and all that, and I'm very much a proponent of that, too. I was shitting on Course of the Conclave last week when we were doing our retro cycle for the Return of Ravnica Legends equivalent of, but in the right deck, she can be an absolute beast. I'm not going to deny that. In fact, I love that about commanders in general, that you can build around and they do stuff like that. What I would like to touch on at some point is just two different commanders that do the same thing, but which one's more optimal? You know, Rift the Awakener versus Hazezan. Hazezan gives you the tokens later, but then Rift is the bigger body and you don't lose anything when she leaves the battlefield. Or Sand Triplets versus Shroom. If I wanted to play EDH.artifacts with triplets, is my deck inherently worse because Shroom has stronger interactions with them? What if I wanted to play Sunburst cards, which we know are overpowered to begin with, using Celestial Dawn?
Is that like a rhetorical question, or are you actually in that one?
I'm actually asking.
Okay, boys and girls, cats and dogs, and whatever else you might be that has ears, it's time for the Commander Cast Home version. This week's question, is there such a thing as an optimum command? My bad. Let's try that again. Is there such a thing as an optimal commander for a deck type? On the Twitter end, we've got Johnny R saying optimum. Probably not. The core of a lot of theme decks work with different generals. Example, Briss, Tulsimir, Trustowny, Tokens. Mikey D says optimal archetypes? Yeah, but that's why we brew to find out what works best. And Kendall Hall, man. Yes, Ramirez de Pietro is the only pirate general, thus he's optimal for a pirate deck. I think old Kendall got us there. Up on the Facebook end, we've got my boy John Butt. Yes, the one you have the most fun with. Willie B says, I hope not. The format would be boring as hell if it could ever be solved. Chris M says, if you know your meta well enough, yes. If you know the graveyard hate is suboptimal, you can really punish people. And we're going to round things out with my boy Patty G, who says no. There you go, kids. Every week, you want to be on this Stay Home Edition? Question gets posted on the Twitter. Question gets posted on the Facebook. Answer it. Be awesome. You be on it. Later.
Oh, so we were talking about, like, a concept of...
Like, if I wanted to play EDH Fun Artifacts, but then the Fun Artifacts I want to play include Sunburst cards. And so I'm playing Celestia Dawn to get 5-color Sunburst, but then I'm having Send Triplets, because then she lets me cast anything from anyone's hand.
Because then you'd have to white mana to play anything you chose.
Right.
Because everything would be white mana.
And then you could spend it as though mana of any color.
As though it was for white mana. So even if your opponent's playing a green deck, you could be able to use your white mana, quote-unquote, to cast your stuff.
Oh, no, wait! Fuck! I don't think that works with Sunburst that way, then.
I don't think it does, but whatever. It's still a good idea.
All right.
Five color.
All right, whatever, Calvin. Go.
But no, but still, like, let's say, for instance, like, you do have a combo that would turn all the mana white, and you can use the white mana to cast stuff from people's hands, and you're using the Centuplets. That's the one that does the, you can use stuff from other people's hands?
Centuplets.
Oh, damn, I added an extra bitch in that. But, yeah, like, if you're going to use, like, the Sin Triplets, that's not so cool as the Triplets. Damn. But, like, yeah, if I could see that actually working, like, if it actually is something, like, because you could use the Triplets to basically cast up on your opponent's hand, and since everything's white mana and you've got white mana, yeah, that could work. I mean, that actually would be pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, that's what my friend does with his control deck. But my question is, if I'm trying to play artifact deck specifically, which one is the more optimal commander, Shroom or Centriplets? Because they're both artifacts, and they both interact with the deck itself.
Yeah, I think Shroom's just, to me, like, I like Shroom better just because there's more to do with her. I've always thought that the Centriplets, like, I've never played against them, but I always thought if I sat across from them, I just, like, want to plow their faces through, you know? Because I really don't like that ability of theirs very much, so... Maybe that's why I would choose Shroom over Centriplets, but when it comes to, like, which is better for an artifact deck, nothing intrinsically about either of them makes them better, necessarily. They're both artifacts. I mean, that's the big thing you want, right?
Okay, so just to kind of get, like, a view of what I personally think of, is there such a thing as an optimized commander? And I would have to say, just to play the devil's advocate, I'm going to say yes, there is such a thing as an optimized commander. Even in this particular situation where we're comparing the Triplets versus Shroom, Will's main question is he's building an artifact deck. Now, while the Triplets are artifact creatures and they do kind of fit that bill, their main premise is not really artifact-based. So if you're building an artifact deck, you know, you can use them, but they're not really searching artifacts. They're not really helping you get artifacts. They're doing other, like, control aspects that can help you win the game by controlling your opponent's hands or getting free stuff from their abilities or paying for stuff. But they're not really doing anything specific for artifacts. Yes, artifacts would be in this category of things that the Triplets can do. But they're not like Shroom, where Shroom literally says artifact in her ability. Shroom really actually wants to be in an artifact deck. Shroom kind of actually deserves to kind of work into, like, an artifact deck due to the fact that her ability, like, what is it? Like, it takes an artifact from the grave and puts it back in your hand, right?
No, puts it on the field.
Yeah, yes. She's better than I thought she was. I rarely play blue, white, and black, so it's like I kind of know the card, but I don't know the card. I mean, we didn't go to high school or anything, so it's like, you know, I don't have, like, her phone number.
This is Commander Cast. Fuck high school diplomas.
Yeah.
Dude, but, I always thought it put it to your hand. I'm not even gonna lie.
But is that all that's in your hand, Cassidy?
Actually, you know, come to think of it, I'm sure I played against it, and I just always, maybe it's just too good. Calvin does have a point.
But yeah, with Shroom, she at least, like, gets the artifact, slaps it on the field. So if you're building an artifact themed deck, just, like, you know, if an artifact blows away, you can always play a general, and she's an artifact creature, and she can get you an artifact back. And in fact, with the Triplets. I keep wanting to say Centuplets. If the Triplets are in the graveyard, Shroom can search them out the graveyard and slap them onto the field too, so you kind of get the usage of both in a Shroom deck. But if you have the Tuplets, she doesn't really help. She doesn't really do much for the actual artifact deck. I mean, granted, if you're playing a blue-black control deck, she would be amazing because she'd be like the optimized version there. I mean, granted, Shroom might have control options, but like the triplets would have the option to kind of like let you do what's in your hand and go with what you have.
So I agree with you, Calvin, in a way. Shroom is better technically, but first off, he wants to make a fun artifact deck, and I think once you put the word fun in front of whatever style or theme you want to go with, it definitely kind of takes that part of the equation out the window. You know, at that point, if you're making a fun deck, you can play any general you want, and it's technically the best for the deck, because the whole point is to be fun, and you've obviously chosen the general that's fun. There is some situations, too, where there's actually a better general, like, you know, I kind of follow the French format a little bit, and, you know, obviously any general that's going to be cast faster and have an early game impact, like Edric was banned because he was too good, that sort of thing. So there is, like, in the sense, if you're making, like, a competitive deck, there is a there's absolutely a general that's best for your deck type, maybe even best in the color combination. It's easier to claim best in color combination when there's only like two or three for some of the shards, you know. But I think for the most part, I mean, Send Triplets is perfectly fine for an artifact deck if it's going to be a fun artifact deck that you want to play Send Triplets with, you know what I mean?
All right. Now, Mr. Advocate, I have a question for you. What if we have two generals that do very similar things and require the deck to do separate tweaks? I play against my friends Hazeza and Tamar deck, which is kind of a token combo-based deck. But I also play against another person's with the Awakener token deck, which does not necessarily combos, but just more token-y stuff in general, like life gain and populating and stuff like that. My question is there an optimal commander between these two generals within Hazeza? Because they, unlike the Send Triplet Shroom example, these both do very similar things.
Yeah, well, when you get into like this particular like aspect of cards that do very similar things, like if you had like Hazad?
Hazeza. Yeah, he's the one who, when he comes into play, the next turn, you get 1-1. Yeah, you get Sand Warriors.
Yeah, like the Sand.
Oh, you're going to have to edit that shit out, or else Chris is going to be really mad.
Look, that's what it is. It's Sand People. It makes Sand People tokens.
Nope. When Hazeza and Tamar enters the battlefield, put X 1/1 Sand Warrior creature tokens that are red, green, and white onto the battlefield at the beginning of your next upkeep, where X is the number of lands you control, and when he leaves, exile all Sand Warriors.
Yeah, it should have been Sand Humans, but still.
Sand Humans. Be politically correct up in here.
But anyway, yeah, but you said you always wanted more humans anyway, so... Sand Human Warrior tokens.
No,
yeah,
that's true.
No, fuck the humans. They just had a whole block.
Yeah, but
still no human tokens, though, except for human tokens. Like, human soldier tokens, we need them. Just saying.
In this particular comparison between Hazeza or... I'm just going to call him Jay-Z. Like, between Jay-Z here and Reese, we have, like, have two generals that fall into an extremely close category. Rick? Okay, yeah, so they both kind of make similar tokens. And they both do make, like, 1-1 creatures, and with them both being in roughly the same mana cost, one being slightly cheaper, I personally still would say that it depends mainly on what your focus for this deck is. If your deck counts, like, green, red, and white creatures, then it might actually be something of interest. If you have a way to try to keep the tokens around after Jay-Z decides to leave the field and get off the stage, then yeah, you can probably find something to work with there. But if I was going to pick one as the more, like, quote-unquote optimum, it would still be Rift, because he's cheaper, he's bigger, he has evasion, so he can still do more on his own. So, like, it's the even though, like, you're like, there's going to be times where the dragon's not going to be as good as Jay-Z is. But in the same token, like, with this particular thing, they're, like, so close, it's kind of like you can toss a coin up in the air, and whichever side it lands on is the side that's good that day.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with you there, Calvin. I kind of think that Jay-Z up in here is kind of he's kind of bad, honestly. The fact that he loses all your tokens when he leaves the battlefield, and he only triggers when he comes into play, means that you can't really abuse it in any way. You're only going to have those sand creatures, unless, like, you know, you play him and sack him to, like, Ashnod's Altar while he's on the stack, kind of like a Fiend Hunter kind of thing, or, like, you know, Mesmeric Fiend or something. And then, but at that point, you're like, this guy's already 7 to cast, you know what I mean? So, like, that just doesn't seem like a very good use of mana, whereas with Rith the Awakener, even though I don't think Rith is all that great, I've never been a big fan, it's much better. I mean, if Rith dies, the tokens stay around, they're easier to come around. I mean, it's so easy to kill 7-drop general. Also, he's Legends. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have the card. I never see that fucker. Like, I don't think he's better at all. I mean...
Well, what I'm saying is that if I had to pick one as the quote-unquote more, like, the better one, it would be Rift, the Awakener. Mm-hmm. But it's the... Depending on how your deck is built. Like, say, for instance, with this particular... Well, with Jay-Z over here, if your deck was built where... Say you had Mimic Bat out, or it was like a deck where you found a way to try to like make copies of or find a way to get them into play other than just casting them from your general zone. Your basic plan is to cast them once and then never have to pay that seven again. I mean, you know, having X Warrior tokens at the beginning of your turn is actually pretty decent for comparison. Because like with Rift, you have to like actually connect. But with Jay-Z over here, you don't really have to connect. You just have to keep him around. And if you can find like a way to make him indestructible or give him hex or some type of like hexproof or shroud or something like that, he can be around for a very long time. I mean, granted, at seven mana, you know, he should have had that built into him. But hey, this is a card from Legends. What you going to do?
Well, like I said, Tyler is actually the guy who's running the Hazezon. After I took my Rift deck apart, he went and built that token deck. It's actually pretty good. He does have a multitude of sack outlets, so he doesn't have to lose his Sand Warrior tokens. He actually uses like the Sand Slash Pokemon card for his Sand Warriors, which I thought was really awesome. And it can combo off as early as turn 4 if he gets all his mana rocks. But that's neither here nor there. But I'm talking isn't necessarily Rift versus Hazezon, because they both make tokens, but in different ways. Whereas Rith, you're almost doing a Voltron kind of style because she actually has to connect to make him. Hazezon, he has the enter the battlefield delay trigger thing. The question still stands, is there an optimal between the two? All things equal, you know, just not even take them into consideration. If you just built a generic Naya token deck, is there an optimal one between the two?
Yes, it would be Rith. He's right. Cheaper, he's bigger, he has evasion.
Yeah, 2/4 for 7 is pretty bad.
The other one, he's a decent size, like a 2/4, but not for 7. When he comes into the battlefield, he has no real abilities to do anything. I mean, he can block, but he's a 2/4. He's going to be blocking anything that's 4 and under and die. And anything 4 and up, he's dying. Whereas with the dragon, he can at least basically still trade with a titan. He can still get across. And since he has flying, he can catch things that's in the air. So if your opponent happens to play something like an Eldrazi Monument, you can still be able to kind of block something and maybe survive, where this guy, he's not doing any of that.
All right. We're about to do the segment, so final thoughts before we wrap this up?
Jay-Z is the shit. But I can't afford him.
No, I just mean on the concept in general.
Oh, concept of optimum deck? Generals? Yeah, well, you know, this is kind of like up in the air, like this options. People have choices. People are already going to have their opinions. And even in this particular situation, like, I consider the dragon to be the optimum, but, you know, there's probably going to be someone out there who has a valid excuse or a reason for why the other one's the optimum choice. Chances are they're probably wrong, but they're still going to try to fight their opinion. And you can't really argue with someone when it comes down to an opinion like that.
Yeah, I mean, I mirror what Calvin says mostly, except for all the weird shades. Yeah. I mean, overall, I think when it comes to optimal generals, it's all up to your own personal taste. I mean, if you want to do something well and perfectly competitively, maybe there's a general that does it best. But for the most part, if you're just making fun decks or you're just making generic decks like generic tokens or just fun artifacts, like, yeah, just play whatever general you want. I mean, it might even just be an issue that you have send triplets and you don't have a Shroom. Like, you know, get off my grill, you know what I mean?
All right, that about wraps it up for our community segment. And I think we pretty much got at that there is no optimal commander as long as you build it around it properly. Because if you're building around it, then the commander you're using is the optimal one anyway. Next up, we're going to go into our strategy segment, where we have Calvin introducing the idea of Lure and Destroy.
Same category.
Oh, he's breaking probation. Oh, that's going to be a sharp spike on the audio.
Okay, everybody, this is Calvin, also known as Captain Resident Raider, isn't it? And this week we're going into the strategy segment. We're going to be talking about a little discussion that's called Lure and Destroy. Now, for those of you out there who don't know what this actually stands for, there are plenty of different ways to actually take out and win and beat opponents. And one of them that we're going to be discussing is the concept of luring and destroying. AKA, we're going to figure out what's the best way to put out a nice tasty piece of fruit in front of our opponent to make them get past their defenses and open their gates a little bit so that we could then send our Trojan horses in there and break them up. Now, the best thing about this particular kind of strategy is that a lot of people kind of don't see it coming, because it usually involves the concept of playing your creatures in a way that makes them less optimum for you, where they actually start thinking, wow, why is he tapping all of his creatures and not doing anything? Maybe he's got nothing. Or he's attacking me with everything and leaving himself wide open. This gives me the perfect chance to attack back, when in reality, you're setting him up for a fog, so you can be able to swing back with another attack the next turn. Or potentially, maybe you want him to attack. You want the damage, because you've got something that's going to convert that damage and direct it somewhere else. Maybe you have a card that's in your hand that says, when target creature attacks, destroy it. This way you can actually be able to knock things out. There's a variety of different ways where this could potentially end up working in your favor. But before I go rambling on and actually end up doing a whole bunch of stuff that people probably don't even want to hear just yet, I'm going to sit back and let the other guys here go ahead and say what they got to say.
Now, see, it's interesting that you bring this up, because this is actually a strategy that any format can be used, not just EDH, where you're playing politics and you're watching out for three other people. This is applicable in both the standard, modern, limited, especially limited, where I've come up across this several times. And you find that you often have to play a level just above your opponent. You have to read what they're doing and know what kind of cards they're doing, but you only have so much time to really get an idea of what their playstyle is. So my question is... Fuck, what was my question? Cassidy, go wild, I think.
Kind of distracted me there with that awesomeness. okay, so I think probably the biggest thing for me would be flash creatures. Like, that would be where I would be really comfortable, like, luring people in by seeming open. Especially something like the Ambush Viper. You know, talking about limited, I played a lot of Innistrad with that flash Death Toucher guy, you know, so, I mean...
Yeah, that guy's the absolute shits.
Right. So, I mean, that's where I would think. I didn't even really think of Condemn and stuff like that. But, yeah, I mean, attack triggers is a really good idea, too. And Fog is can be pretty annoying when someone thinks that they got you beat. So, basically, we're talking about, like, leaving yourself open, right? Or are we just talking about slowing your roll when it comes to creatures, like, not playing your better ones? Because there's, like, kind of a difference. Like, it's kind of obvious when you tap out to attack that, like, you're not letting yourself die unless you're really dumb. So, I mean, I don't know who you play against, Calvin, just saying. They well, probably see the fog coming.
I think what the general idea that Calvin's doing is we're going to go ahead and lay out some bait. For example, there have been times in where I've been playing multiplayer with my Kalia deck, and instead of going aggro if I know that I'm in for a longer game, I'm actually going to play her out at a time where it's actually good for me to play her. But at the same time, I'm not expecting her to live at all. I'm actually using her to force someone to spend the removal on her so that I can play an even bigger threat on my next turn. And my friend Tyler, who I was talking about earlier in the podcast, is actually a master at this somehow. He always has these Xanatos Gambits where he plays this big threat. And if it survives, oh, fuck yeah, I'm going to wreck face with you now, boy. But if it doesn't survive, then you just wasted that spot removal on the Kiki Jiki that he was holding back in his hand to combo off with.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I could see where you're going with that, definitely. I'll always try to play the less important pieces first, like, not less important necessarily, but, like, more
the
like...
ones
you know,
sacrifice?
Yeah, like, kind of like the Solemn Simulacrums, just the guys that do stuff, and then you can, like, let them die. You'll always want to hold back, like, something like Seedborn Muse, where, like, that's going to be your win card, that kind of thing. Like, I won't play that till later, because, yeah, you definitely want to soak up all the removal, especially with something that seems scary to your opponents, but you know that it's not like part of your deck as much, you know what I mean? Like, there's some cards like Kiki Jiki could be like a killer combo card, but if you play her and she gets lightning bolted and you don't really have much to do with her, that just means that the players think that they actually got one up on you because you lost a really good card too. So I mean, there's also that, sacrificing something that is pretty powerful, but not almost. I don't know if it's a Trojan horse is a good idea, but or a good metaphor for it. But you know, some sort of a I don't know.
In this case, it's really more of a like a decoy duck. You know,
yeah,
you,
decoy. That's the word I was thinking. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. You wind it up and you set it off, and you let them follow that while you actually sneak them around, and then you just shiv them right up the ass. All ninja
like.
The ass ninjas. That's actually a thing in Japan. It's like using for them.
Like, oh no, it's the ass ninjas.
Yeah. This is always a thing in Japan.
Rectum. Rectum, I think near killed them.
Two things it always comes back to when Off Color Cast and Commander Cast meet. dick jokes and ninjas. Straight up. But when you mentioned the Psalm Simulacrum, I actually think that's not really what we're going for here, because Psalm Simulacrum is something you want to die anyway, and something that people are actively going to avoid killing.
Yeah, fair enough.
The idea is to draw in their resources and to get them to use them in misdirection, this is actually like putting out your Seaborn Muse and expecting it to get Path to Exile or whatever, so that you can drop your combo piece on the next turn.
Well, in my case, Seaborn Muse is actually my combo, so I would keep that and drop something like Primeval Titan or something.
right before you got banned.
Right. Yeah, something. I don't know. I still play him. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, fuck the rules.
Yeah, what I'm actually saying is, like, kind of similar to what we was just discussing. Like, there's going to be times where, like, say, for instance, like, you know, you can see the writing on the wall. This would be a great time to play Krenko Mob Boss from your Goblin deck. But you also realize that if I play Krenko now and he doesn't make it, I'm really just going to screw myself. So then you kind of do something, like, say you toss down Ib. Like, say you have, like, your deck general is Krenko, but you have Ib in hand. You play Ib so people see Ib, and then they kind of understand why you're attacking with Ib and why you're attacking with other creatures, and maybe he's doing a little land sacrificing to get some creatures on the board. So they kind of go after Ib, but not realizing that the only reason that you're doing it is so they can leave their resources open. And then eventually, like, you know, oh, there's, like, an anger in the graveyard, and we're going to, and as soon as your creatures are down, I'm going to go next turn, Krenko, tap him, because he's got haste. His creatures are going to double up in the tokens, and those tokens are going to smash your face in.
All right, so how much are you actually willing to gamble to try and draw out one of his answers? If you're pretty sure that your opponent has a counterspell, are you willing to play a Wrath when it's going to devastate his position, but it's going to take yours out too? Are you willing to go that extra mile just to draw out a counterspell to prevent your next item from being countered?
Me personally, like, I'm a very red player, and when I say that, I really do mean, like, it's not just because of the colors. It's like, my concept is, you have the
I thought you were black.
No, I'm red. like I'm red on the inside. Like, this Hershey-colored skin tone doesn't really do anything. Like, but, like, you know, once you get past this, like, chocolate layering, there's actually, like, red on the inside.
Like a raspberry cake or something?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like a chocolate covered cherry.
Oh, that is gold.
But yeah, like, so, like, I'm really, like, a red player, and my thing is, like, you've either got the answer or you don't. You've got the ability or you don't. And I have a tendency to kind of just be like, look, I know there's a very good chance that you may have a counterspell. So you know what? I'm not going to play Krenko because, you know, I don't feel like having to pay an extra two. Because if I do, then Krenko is going to go away. But I will continue to keep playing and keep throwing stuff at you until I eventually, where if a turn goes by and I cast something from my hand and I know that it's something you don't want on the field and you don't counter it, oh, next turn Krenko is coming down. You're going to get the rest of this field because, you know, it's kind of just like you have to feel it. And like some people out there, they're like, you know, very smart and educated and go through the whole process of sitting back and thinking about every particular move that your opponent could possibly make and like, oh, he's playing green-white and I've got this. This is possibly the only counter spell type card in these particular color combinations he can use. That's not me. I don't waste time thinking about all the counter spells and options you have. I like to make my own options, and by doing so, I kind of just say, if you got it, you got it. If you don't, then you know what? There's a very good chance you're going to be dead next turn, so it doesn't really matter, does it?
Yeah, who needs to think in a game where you just sling around cards all day?
Right. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are a lot of people out there, I know a few, who really will get to the point where they sit back and they will drag a game out an extra, like, 10 to 15 minutes. And I'm, like, I've actually sat there, like, dude, why don't you just play your card? It's like, yeah, but he might counter it. And I was like, so? What? If he counters it, I might lose. Like, yeah, but you're pretty much going to lose anyway because the time's going to run out.
Actually, I'm just waiting for the right time to optimize my answers because I have a good hunch that if I do this, it's going to be pretty ineffectual and I don't really want to lose my card.
Whatever, dude. I'm going to go ahead and play my goblin. You got an answer? Yeah, that's what I thought. Swing.
Yeah, shut that neckbeard up. Cassidy, you're next.
I think I'm kind of the opposite there. I mean, like, your example was wrathing the board to, like, put them at a worse state than you and force the counterspell so that you, or, you know, so that if they, once they do, you can just do what you want to do anyways. And I'm a big fan of that. I will definitely watch out for counterspells, but, you know, I play against a lot of blue decks and a lot of people that are really cerebral when it comes to it, so, like, I always have to be on the lookout for even trick binds. Like, I'll wait to play stuff until that trick bind mana is not up, you know what I mean? That kind of thing, and arcane denial and stuff. So, like, a lot of times, even if they don't, if they say they do let the Wrath of God go off, and, like, I'm like, well, maybe they don't have a counterspell, then I'll still try to wait until I'm sure that they can't cast something like Arcane Denial. But, I mean, with Force of Will and Pact of Negation around, it's kind of hard to ever play around it. I would say that you don't have to be necessarily a cerebral player, like a thinking man, like Calvin's talking about, to sometimes know what your opponent's going to do, especially if you play against the deck a lot, you know what I mean? Like,
if you play with someone on the regular, then you have a good idea of what their game plan is, what cards they're like to have.
Right, exactly. And you'll know that, I mean, against the Mind Over Matter Temple Bell deck that I play against a lot, I know that every piece of removal needs to be for those cards and those cards alone. So I will definitely let other things slide, waiting for that one moment to stop that deck altogether. And that's just the way it is to have to win against combo decks. You have to kind of, like, you have to know which piece you're playing against. You know, that same example of where you counter the, you play that Wrath, if you're playing against people you don't know, like a tournament or just, like, just some new people that you just met, like, that's an ideal strategy, because when you don't know the deck that you're playing against, 9 times out of 10, that person's going to counter that Wrath of God, because they probably think that that's just you delaying the game or you trying to not be killed by them, even though it's not really why you're playing the Wrath of God at all. You know, it's the decoy, like you said, so.
All right, now we talked about trying to draw out that counterspell, but let's talk about the other way that we lure and destroy here, setting the trap itself. Like, how do you telegraph that appropriately? There's obviously the, all right, I'm going to go herp the dirt, I'm going to swing out at you, even though one attack from this other guy is going to kill me. Yeah, something's going to be up there, but how do you find the best way to telegraph that, not necessarily to telegraph, but to hide your trap, cover your tracks, so that no one suspects that you're setting something up without being too obvious?
One of the things that I would have to say is a good way to hide your tracks. I'm getting Elmer Fudd over here.
We're hunting rabbit tracks.
Rabbit tracks. A good way, like, I personally kind of like to do certain things with that is that, one, try to do what you can to break up what you're doing. Like, you don't want to be like, you know, be like, oh, it's my turn. Okay, skip the main phase, go straight to attack, tap everything, swing, go. Because, you know, this is just kind of the, okay, why did you just blow through everything? You know, sometimes you got to sit there like, okay, main phase. I'm going to play a land. Sit back. Okay. And then you kind of, like, take your creatures and you kind of tap them sideways to kind of see it, make it look like you're trying to make a decision. Okay, if I do this, this, and this, and that's this much damage, and then I can send this there and keep this for blocking.
Well, at that point, you're pretty much just bluffing, aren't you?
Yeah. Because the whole point of the lore of the bathing is bluffing. You see, the whole point of this main segment is you have to kind of bluff and let your opponent feel like he's doing what he can to calculate a way to win, and he thinks he sees it. And like, oh, okay, I got it. Here, the best way to do this is to attack you with these guys. I'm going to attack him with these, and I'm going to keep these two back for blockers.
So what you're basically saying is kind of give him the incentive to attack you without actually really doing anything, and that turns up bluffing. Because when I thought of this, what I was thinking was, go ahead and just give them that target that they couldn't resist attacking. But what you're saying is that you don't necessarily want to make them want to attack you. You want to make them think that they have to attack you.
Well, in certain situations, it can go either way. Like, say, for instance, like, if you're around people who you know can't resist the concept of an open player, they're just like, oh, my God, this guy's completely wide open, and he's got, like, 3 turns of attacks coming at him. We're going to smash his face in. Then, yeah, go right ahead. Attack with everything if you have something that's going to keep you alive and they don't know it. If they're the kind of people who just can't resist that option, go for it. But at the average table, you kind of have to, I mean, it's the concept of the dollar in the street. Okay? A lot of people will walk by, they'll see a dollar laying down there, and most people will go for it. But then some people will look down, but if, like, you know, they're looking around, and if you see, like, a dude kind of hiding behind a corner, and you kind of, like, start to notice the dollar twitches slightly.
Wait.
Going for it. It's too obvious.
Wait, so that was you behind the bush?
Yeah, that was me.
Oh, God.
I was back there taking a piss.
You know, it's attached to the zipper on his trousers.
Yeah.
You know, I would have seen the zipper, but I was too busy paying attention to the enormous dick attached to it.
You were like, oh, I got a dollar for you. Oh, you can be quicker than that.
It's twitching, and he's like, no hands. So I think the key to it is making it so it's not obvious. I'll just go with like kind of the wrestling common sense. You know, if you're gonna be faking it, at least make it seem like you're not faking it. You know what I mean? Like in the instance where we're playing the Wrath of God to lure out a counter spell, we're not gonna be like, oh, I hope this gets countered. We'll be like, yeah, this is the answer. And like what Calvin said with going straight to your attack phase, you know, just like derping around, like that helps a lot too. Just part of the bluffing and just selling it. Like I'm known as being pretty derpy. And I make a lot of attacks that I decided not to, like, earlier in my turn. But then after I played stuff, I'm like, yeah, let's attack. And when I actually do stuff on purpose, nefariously, it usually catches people off guard because they're just like, oh, he's dumb, he's attacking. What an idiot. And I'm like, oh, fuck, haha, stupid, you know, that kind of thing. But,
yeah, fuck! Yeah.
I think the key is to not do it too much, to not be too obvious. Like, in the example where you're leaving yourself open, I mean, it's pretty obvious you have a fog unless it's really, really bad, unless you're like playing like I do. But I mean, the situation with the Wrath of God, which is usually the situations I come across more, baiting the counter spells and you know, playing the spell that they have to counter, and then the spell afterwards that they can't counter and lose to. That's like my favorite kind of thing.
Now, quick question as we wrap this up: have you guys ever turned that inside out and looked so obvious as to dissuade everyone from attacking you because they're thinking, "Oh, that guy's obviously got a trap."
Yes.
That's the other side of the coin, is when you don't have a fog, you just pretend to have it, right?
Oh, yeah, but those are the best times, Cass. Those are the best times. Especially when you're, like, someone that people kind of feel they know.
Yeah, like Andy was talking about a couple of seasons ago when it was pretty much fogs the whole season. Once you start playing fogs during multiple combat steps, it starts to get inside of people's head. Oh, does he have a fog? I better not attack him. Oh, he's leaving himself wide open. He obviously has a fog. Well, I'll just have my counterspell ready for that. Oh, he's playing a big spell? No, I've got to hold that for the fog so I can kill him.
Yeah. Uh-oh, yeah. I just lost.
All right.
Like I've always found it amazing because it's so juicy. It's so fun to just be the guy that's like, okay, I'm going to keep attacking you. I'm going to keep attacking you. It's like, and then there's that turn where it's like, hey, that's just Calvin. He attacks with everything all the damn time. And then it's like this, the one time Calvin pulls up his defenses and they're like, oh shit, he ain't got nothing. Get him! Get him! And they turn around and it's like, pump spell, bitches. And they're like, run into like a wall of nuts. And you know, like all their creatures just become like a nice body pile in front of my defending creatures.
Yeah, everyone get in the line so Calvin can teabag you.
Yeah, here you go. Prepare for it. You're next.
All right, that was Calvin's strategy segment on the Lure and Destroy. If I actually would like to hear some great stories about this, maybe some epic maneuvers or barrel rolls that you yourself pulled with such a strategy, go ahead and leave them in the comments or email us at commandercast@gmail.com, because I really don't think anything like this is going to fit on the Twitter account. Next up, we're going to head into another one of Calvin's segments in the technology segment where we review EDH Freshmen.
I said 1408.
Oh shit. Better get the panel for this. Hold on.
Okay, everybody. And now we're going into the technology segment here. Yeah, I know you're probably getting tired of hearing the sound of my voice, but you know what? If that was the case, you probably wouldn't be listening to this episode anyway. Like, you saw my name in the titles. You knew what this was.
You know, Calvin, I can never get tired of you, Calvin. I love you too much.
I can't stop quitting you.
I'm addicted to your chocolate.
Yeah. Like, you just want me from my insides. Like, oh, is that milk chocolate too?
All the girls want Calvin's sweet chocolate.
Yeah. It's like 6.5. Let's see.
Red zone in the center.
But this particular, on this week for the technology segment, going into what we call the EDH freshman tribes. And for those of you who don't really understand what I'm talking about, there are a couple of tribes out there that are considered, that I like to consider the upperclassmen. And they're the tribes that you know. Elves, goblins, wizards, all those things. They're always the top, right there, in the front. But then there's a few tribes that's, like, way down at the bottom. And they're, like, you know, the tribes that kind of, like, wish that they could have enough creature types to build a deck. And they're, like, please, wizards, print more of me. And then, like, wizard prints, like, a few, just a couple. But they're in the wrong colors. And we don't have a lord, and we don't have a general yet. And come on, wizards, hook us up. And then you end up with, like, you know, a few tribes, like the ones that just don't get the love that they need. But in this particular segment with the freshman tribes, we're talking about some of the freshmen that we feel might actually be worth coming up on and actually trying to remember that they're actually not nearly as bad as they used to be, because they've actually gotten pretty damn good over the last couple of years, especially with, what was it, the Innistrad block and the Abyssin Restored. One of the main tribes we're going to be probably discussing here are going to be like the humans. The concept of like maybe a few other creatures and lungs of that, how they've actually gotten better like over the years. Q. Oh, you got something to say there, Willy?
I do have something to say, Calvi. The fuck?
That didn't come out nearly as awesome as I thought that was going to be.
Yeah. Vampires are actually a perfect example of this. They got a huge support in Innistrad, which Innistrad was built to be tribal to begin with, aside as a sub-theme, actually. But before Zendikar, I don't really remember seeing too many vampires. You had a couple of tricolors and shards of Alarum and the Grixis shard, but outside of that, there really wasn't that much. They did have their Baron Sanguir and all those stuff. They had their legends, but they weren't really the flagship creature that they were now. Then Zendikar comes along, and suddenly they're a lot more focused. We actually have vampires at common, uncommon, and rare, and we feel the tribal theme there. We see that they're these savage people who go around shooting down motherfuckers and just sucking them dry. We lost a couple of them in Scars, but there was still the continuity that they exist. You see them on Exsanguinate, there were a few vampires that had those really long fingers that they sucked blood with. And then we get back to Innistrad, and we have a whole tribal around them. We get a lord, we get a legendary creature, we get the idea that vampires are not just black, but black-red, which I feel was a really good way to kind of expand their colors, because now we have mono-red vampires as opposed to just the Grixis vampires, like your Ghazazol. And now we're going into Return to Ravnica and Gatecrash. Gatecrash in particular, because the Dimir Guild is actually the guild that has the vampires, similar to how Baros has angels, and how, I don't know, whatever the fuck the girl have. They just take whatever they find on the streets.
Usually beasts, yeah.
And a few elementals. Yeah. But each guild kind of has that trademark creature that they have. You know, only Baros have angels, unless they defect to Orzhov. Something like that.
Yeah, I can see where you're going at.
Yeah, zombies have always been the flagship race, and they have been for a long time. But vampires have gotten some real strong love lately.
Yeah, I don't really see that a lot of other... Like, we were talking about this before the show, and I was having trouble kind of figuring out what I wanted to do. I don't really think there's as many good examples as vampires, because vampires really did come out of nowhere. I mean, there was, like, that one, the Sengir vampire, you know, from the old school, and then, like, not much, and then all of a sudden, oh, who are zombies? Fuck you, we're vampires. And then, like, we kind of talked about humans, but I'm not really sure that flies, because mostly old cards that I liked playing back in the day weren't humans at the time, but they've all been retconned to be humans, and there's still not really much of a human general. I see what you're saying with the vampires, but besides that, I don't really see a lot of other actual clans too much. We did talk about the illusions, so I guess I'll bring that up, because they actually have a lord. There's a lot of old illusions, though, then. Like, none of them, like, really stick out in your mind, so you're kind of stuck using the Phantasmal ones and a few other cool ones here and there. So, like, that's kind of a hard one, too. So, I don't know. I guess you can just talk, Calvin.
All right, so, hold on a second. You can't talk about illusions without talking about the greatest, most perfect illusion creature that ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
The blue legendary guy cast. Exactly who I'm talking about. Mr.
What?
Everything. Mr. I'm all stuff.
Oh,
all
the Storm Ultimus?
Oh, shit. Oh, you know what we can't go through one tribal segment without mentioning? Archers.
Archers.
Yeah,
archers.
And no, we're not talking about the cartoon show on FX. We're talking about, like, people with bow and arrows.
I know Andy had a real hate-on for archers and advisors. Just the two creature types he absolutely hated. I actually really like archers. I'm going to say that right now. Start breaking out of Andy's shell.
But,
and we've seen Yeah, I actually like archers. Like, we had Falcon Wrath Exterminator. I think. Falcon Wrath Exterminator. I actually like that we're starting to see more archers. We don't necessarily have that new age tribal lord and anytime I say New Age, it's going to be post Lorwyn, because they did have an Archer Lord back then, but you know, we haven't seen that much support for them now. But we are seeing more archers that are specifically made to be archers instead of this retconned soldier archer bullshit.
I think that the Exterminator should be an assassin, though. That's just me. I don't know. Like, I was really bummed when I read Archer instead of Assassin. Like, no! Like, that's a tribe that needs a real fucking leader. That's what I'm saying.
The only leader the assassins need is the coin to lead them to the next kill.
Well, they need a general, or else you can't build it.
Well, no,
that would be, yeah, but you see, in that case, then the assassin's leader would have to be Gwafa Hazid, because he has bribery counters. But yeah, like, so, Cass, like, I understand that, like, you personally don't really see Aegis as, like, a quote-unquote, like, freshman tribe. Cool. And, you know, I'll give you that. I wouldn't consider Aegis as, like, the freshman.
Actually, I kind of thought the Angels was my first thought, but we all kind of agreed that, like, Angels have always been awesome, kind of.
But the problem with the Angels in, like, say, this particular format is that up until recently, you really had to play with the really big ones. They really didn't come in, like, anything lower than a 5 casting cost, did they?
Not really. Remember, Urza's Saga took place in Sarah's realm, and she actually had a lot of stuff that were either Angels or a retcon to be Angels.
Like Curator or whatever, the one that's pro artifacts. I think that was an angel and like
Angelic Page.
Angelic Page, right? Exactly. So Sarah, I mean, there are
Sarah Advocate. You know, there were plenty of four cost and lower angels in Urza Saga. Mm-hmm. Actually, just the Urza block in general.
Yeah, but up until like they actually decided to recon them, they weren't really like. I mean, they were.
No, there were plenty. There were plenty of angels there. I think.
Yeah, there's plenty of angels there story-wise, but, like, as far as I know, like, angels, for the most part, up until, like, recently, have been the big flyer, the dragon of white, if you will.
Well, yes, but I'm telling you, there were actual angel-type creatures in the Urza block that were small.
Yeah, but what were their casting? Urza block?
Yeah, Urza block.
Like, let's see. I gotta find some of these angels.
There is actually one I wanted to bring up, if you don't mind.
Oh, go ahead.
Actually, even though angels did have the Urza's block, there's not been a lot of demons. And actually, they've been missing from the story a lot just because of, like, the whole, like, negative images that they used to bring up for, like, you know, any dumbass who doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about. Like, oh, unholy strength, my kid's worshipping Satan by enchanting his creature. No, it's not happening. Anyways... demons recently have been really, really good, too. There's not a lot of cheap demons as much, because, like, that's kind of outside of the flavor of them, right? You know, there's devils, and then there's their thralls, but usually demons are badass. I will mention that they definitely have better cards, like Runescar Demon, Gristlebrand, like, these all make Lord of the Pit, and Lord of the Pit was almost the best of all of them, basically. I mean, there wasn't a lot of functional demons until very recently, starting with Innistrad, almost with the Bloodgift Demon, and then Runescar Demon. Like, those were the first two, you know, and from there, we've got a lot of really good demons, even cheap ones. Yeah, I guess there's the Abyssal Persecutor and stuff like that, but for the most part, I think they're not necessarily a tribe as much, but, like, we're seeing more and more that they're, like, at least a creature type, and, I mean, Kalia definitely makes them worth playing anyways. It'd be nice to see some cheap demons, or at least, like, some, like, humans that have, like, demon type, but they're not actual demons. Like, that'd be pretty cool,
like,
you know?
Like, human, like weird human-demon creatures?
Yeah, like almost like thralls having demon as a type, so maybe you can make like a thrall demon deck.
Don't forget Demon Lord of Aztamouth.
Yeah, Aztamouth.
Harvester of Souls.
Yeah, Harvester of Souls is very good.
Now, it's funny that you actually bring up demons, because I actually was on Tumblr earlier today, and there's this like this 4-page thing comparing angels to demons and the different numbers they have. Like,
oh, yeah.
You've seen that, right?
Yeah, it was on Gathering Magic, I think, is where I saw it, yeah.
I have not seen. That actually sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and have a link in the show notes. But basically, by the numbers, the angels vastly outnumber the demons. I think the only thing the demons really won statistically was number of tramplers.
That's awesome.
Angels also win for having the only creature in the two types that looks like it should have flying, but doesn't.
One of the other things I kind of wanted to talk about was werewolves eventually, but it's one of the it's more of something I kind of wanted to kind of toss out there as an idea. Now, while the werewolves in and of themselves before, like, recently in Innistrad, they were pretty much, like, nowhere. It was, like, what, three dudes in black, and that was about it?
It was like lesser werewolf, greater werewolf, and then some other fucking werewolf that wasn't really a werewolf.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that's basically all werewolves had up until, like, literally just now. The thing for me about it is with werewolves is, like, since they are now in, like, red and green, technically, quote-unquote, in black, they don't actually have, like, a wolf legend. Granted, this particular topic has been plowed into the dirt about why the werewolves don't have a wolf legend and wizards being, sorry, didn't realize we made a mistake here, which is whatever. That one's done and put into the dirt. One of the concepts that I was saying here is that for these particular creatures, what I've been thinking about recently is like, what about if we just took the werewolves and the wolf deer and whatever other random monsters happened to go into red, blue, not red and green? What other monsters were there? It was zombies, right? Vampires were red.
Yeah, there were red vampires, and then you had some green spirits.
Yeah, so if you, like, take, like, the spirits and the werewolves and a few vampires, you could easily build, like, a...
Humans! They had green humans.
Yeah, but I don't trust humans.
Yeah, because they turned into werewolves.
Oh, yeah. The human werewolves? Yeah. Yeah, that was their creature type. What I'm thinking here is that if we were to take these creatures, we could probably slap them all into a nice deck of freshman monsters and kind of try to make a nice little theme deck out of them, kind of with the human hunter, and probably use some type of human creature that can actually go, that's in both colors. What was it, Rada?
Rada Erdekeld.
No, she's an elf.
Yeah.
So, do we have a red-green human?
Creature.
Because I know we have Kresh of the Bloodbraider. He's a legendary human. He's also red-green and black, so you could be able to pull the other black werewolves in if you wanted to. And have Kresh kind of just being like the Van Helsing of your deck, where his whole goal is basically just to kind of be there as the one human fighting against the monsters.
All right, Calvin, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news for you. Actually, no. You know what? No bad news whatsoever. This is all awesome. There are 5 red-green humans that are legendary.
All right. To me.
The even more awesome is that they are Gerarda the Closed Fist, Livania Salone, Stang, Sinestian Falconer, and Tuknir Deathlock. All 5 of them are legends.
Wait, isn't Tuknir, isn't he Naya?
Tuknir Deathlock is double green, double red. Oh. It's a legendary human wizard. And it's a 2/2 flying wizard that has pay green and red, tap. Target creature gets 2/2 until end of turn.
Yeah. He's got an awesome, like, Triceratops, like, helmet thing going on.
Yeah! Oh, that is so awesome!
Yeah, he is one of the coolest. And he has an awesome name, too. I've always been a big fan.
No, it's not just a Triceratops. It looks like he has a T-Rex jaw over his mouth for the rest of the helmet. He's got a T-Rex on top of a Triceratops. Oh my god, that's so fucking awesome!
What? Like, he's, like, underneath, like, it looks like he just got, like, spit up at by, like, a dragon. He's, like, covered in ash and shit. Really bad.
Yeah, actually, I kind of like that image.
Oh, that is so awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that would be a good general for, like, a red-green werewolf-themed deck, because you have, like, a creature who you can actually, like, use as a way to kind of pump your creatures up as well. And with the very low mana cost of double red, double green, it's not too difficult to put out. Even though I have no idea where she would get flying from, but I'm assuming that's a dragon thing.
I'm actually kind of partial to Livania. Livania Salone is a 2 double green, double red, so she costs 6. She's a legendary human warrior. She's a 4/4. She has first strike and legendary land walk.
Ah, she could be real good in those decks, because, like, in EDH, a lot of people do have a tendency to play a lot of legendary creatures and legendary lands as well.
Yeah, Corhaven, Gaia's Cradle. If you're looking for a Van Helsing, she's the fucking Van Helsing.
Right, so she's legendary. She has legendary land walk, so she can come down. She can go wherever she chooses, as long as it's a legendary land there. So she's headed towards your Castlevania. She's going to get there, whether you like it or not. People know what land is in. She's getting it.
Yep, Livania and Tuknir, Commander Kestek, only get it here.
She would go pretty good with a Bizarre Trader. You can just give away your legendary lands if they don't have one.
Give away your Shivan Gorge.
Yeah. Here you go. Now you can't block me.
Now, well, I'll just pin you for 1 in 3? What? cry quietly in the corner.
You have to remember, this is red and green. She's going to be huge. You can always put down stuff that's going to pump her up. Like, these are the colors of giant growths and fireballs and stuff, and, like, fire breathing. And, like, so when you're got a legendary creature that has legendary land walk, and you're in red and green, you have more than enough ways to, like, get her largely huge. Does that even work? Yeah, fuck it. Largely huge. And actually be able to get in there and, like, do enough general damage to at least kill one person off. And you can stick the wolves on the other person. It's a win.
Yeah, especially with, like, the new Blood Rush cards from Gatecrash. Those look fucking sweet on her.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, she's got pretty cool art, too. RK, Richard Kane Ferguson, is always pretty good. And it's probably one of his most actual visible. Like, you can look at it without getting nauseous, right?
Well, I suppose. Well, no. If you get noxious at the sight of blood, because she's cutting down mofos like a boss. Yep.
My screen's so small, so hard to see the awesome parts of it. I hate this.
Oh,
yep.
The screen's so small.
Guy, the sad part is the guy probably just wanted a staple or something. Hey, Lavanya, can I get like a staple? Oh my god, my kidney! Okay. I think we're just about done here. Any final thoughts on EDH freshman guys?
Me personally, there's a bunch of creatures out there that are pretty decent. There's a couple of creature types out there that more likely will get some love sooner or later. Eventually, like, you know, these are the creatures that you won't even notice that you don't have until Wizards prints out something and you're like, oh my god, I didn't realize we didn't have this.
Oh, okay.
But they have no excuse for not treating dwarves better.
Oh, yeah. There's actually been some talk, from what I hear, if you follow Mark Rosewater's blog, he says that they are currently talking about maybe moving dwarves to white, which I think would be a pretty good move. Because I don't want to see any more fucking Kithkin in my white. I really don't.
Well, I mean, I don't see why they don't just, like, rename Kithkin altogether. Be like halflings, right?
Dumb. Oh, no. You know what would be awesome? We get an Oros Dega Wedge dwarf. That would be so fucking awesome. All right. Cassidy, final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Besides vampires, I don't think there's been a lot of innovation when it comes to tribes. You know, a lot of the sets we've been going to recently have been revisited, you know, Scars and Ravnica, so it's kind of like, it's a little difficult to get new cards, new tribes going. I'm hoping that the next set at least has something kind of interesting, you know. I mean, even seeing something new, blue creatures or just something, you know, I don't know.
Wait, have you seen the stuff that Simic is coming out with? We've got like a human ooze guy.
Oh, actually, I mean, I was going to mention all the hybrids, but that doesn't really count as far as that goes. But Simic is pretty fucking sweet. So, I mean, what does that the sudden transmogrification or whatever do? It turns you into a lizard.
Frog lizard.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, I mean, there is innovation there, but I mean, I'm really hoping to see something new. And also, I will say that I don't like the vampires at all, but that's probably just Twilight and True Blood. And just like, no, go away, vampires. Can't you not ruin magic, please?
Yeah, fuck that shit. All right, real quick, before we close things out, everyone's going to go ahead and... Oh, on the spot, list a tribe that you would like to see more support for in the future. I'm going to go ahead and say Spellshapers.
I had to pick a tribe off the top that I want to see more support for in the future. I'm on the spot here. Damn.
All right, Calvin, you're done. Cassidy, go ahead.
I'm going to take two. I'm going to steal Calvin's. So I'm going to go first off assassins, because it's just obvious that assassins are awesome. We need a ninja general as well, and then also more a knight general, better knight generals, like Kate. Knigget's, I want.
All right, there we go. I gave you one. Cassie gave you three. Calvin, last chance.
You a freak?
What?
Oh,
I like genies. Let's go with genies.
Yeah,
genies seem pretty good. Seem like a decent alternative to sphinxes.
Yeah, dude, like a cool like Alibaba character or Aladdin character who like is like a djinn lord, right? Like he's a human, but he like gives djinn bonuses and stuff like that. That'd be awesome.
Protect the lamp and all that.
Yeah.
A dude that's racist.
All right. What?
I don't know. I just had to say it sooner or later.
You can't get through a podcast with Calvin without someone being called a racist. This is true.
Yeah.
All right.
So that wraps it up for our first technology segment where we talked about EDH freshman tribes. If you have a tribe that you'd like to see more of or if you have a tribe that we probably missed because we were pretty much just bullshitting this whole segment, go ahead and leave it down in the comments. We're going to go into our second retro cycle in as many podcasts, try and cram as much Return of Radical stuff in as possible. We're actually going to do a retro cycle review on the Golden Ages.
Hold on. I gotta get this girl out of here.
Basically, for the final technology segment and the final segment of the day, we're going to do a retro cycle review. And this time it's of guild mages. And when we say guild mages, there are a lot of different guild mages. So we're actually going to talk about the original Ravnica guild mages, but only the five colors that were in Return to Ravnica. So that'll be, you know, it'll be the Rakdos, Azorius, Golgari, Izzet, and Selednia. So we're going to be talking about the old guild mages, but it's going to be based on what's already come out new, if that makes sense to people. I'm going to do Rakdos first here, which is cool because I like me Rakdos. And the Rakdos guild mage is black-black or red-red split. So it's two in with those two splits. It's a zombie shaman. It also has probably the best picture of all of the guild mages. I'll just say that right now. And it's 2-2. And it has the two abilities, of course. One of them is play three colorless black, discard a card, target creature gets -2/-2 until end of turn. The other is three and a red, put a 2/1 red goblin creature token with haste onto the battlefield, and then exile at the beginning of the next end step. Calvin, I guess.
So the next one? Actually, you know what? We're just to get this out of the way, all the mana costs and the creature power and toughness are all the same. They're all 2/2s for a hybrid color of their corresponding thing. So it's with Golgari, it's black and green. So it's a black green hybrid color kind of thing. So it's only really two mana.
Yeah, we can go ahead and skip the mana cost and the power and toughness. Yeah,
that way we can just kind of like get past those parts. But it's a Golgari Guild Mage. It's an elf shaman, and it has two abilities. One of the abilities is pay 4 and a black, and sacrifice a creature. Return target creature card from your graveyard to your hand. And the second ability is pay 4 and a green, put a +1 counter on target creature.
All right, I've got the Izzet Guild Mage next. He's a human wizard. He has pay 2 and a blue, copy target instant spell you control with converted mana cost 2 or less. You may choose new targets for the copy. He also has pay 2 colors, pay red, copy target sorcery spell you control with converted mana cost 2 or less. You may choose new targets for the copy. So he basically copies either your instants or sorceries for blue or red. And you can go ahead and choose the new copies. And he's got the craziest hair I've ever seen.
Okay, so since it's back around, we're going with the Azorius Guild Mage, one of my personal favorites of the five from this particular list. It's a Baldalkin Wizard. It has the ability of pay 2 and a white, tap target creature. Or you have a second ability, which is pay 2 and a blue, counter target activated ability. And in parentheses, it has the description that mana abilities cannot be targeted.
Okay, I guess I'll finish up with the Selesnya one then. Now, this is an elf wizard. And for 3 and a green, you can put a 1/1 sapling creature token onto the battlefield. And for 3 and a white, creatures you control get +1/+1 until end of turn.
All right, normally what we do with the retro cycle review is we go ahead and we order them from best to worst. You know, a 1 through 5 kind of thing. But that was so horrendous last week that I really didn't want to have to bother doing that again. So right now, we're just going to go ahead and talk about our thoughts on them. And just do a kind of review in retrospective how well they apply to the EDH scene. And we're going to go ahead and continue the cycle by circling right back around. We're going to go ahead and talk about the Rakdos Guild Mage first.
You know, I play Rakdos in my Karavak deck. Rakdos colors, that is. And I don't actually use this guy. I don't really particularly like any of the guild mages that require you to discard a card and pay the cost because it just seems so steep for the ability. I kind of like the goblin ability on it. That's kind of cool, but I mean, it's not something that I use very much, and I've never considered it one of the better ones.
Yeah, this is a card I'm not really looking to try and include in my decks, which is a real shame, because I usually love putting in guild stuff in the decks of those colors. I can actually live with a discard card cost, because it seems like it would be really good in a reanimator deck. Like, you, maybe you're playing Cedrus and you want to use a really expensive ETB effect. Just go ahead and pay that lesser cost. But I think what really kills this card is the mana cost you have to pay with him. Three colorless plus a color to get a 2-red, 2-1 goblin that's going to be exiled at the end step. Or just as a discard outlet for the first ability, just give a target creature -2/-2. Now, that's probably going to kill a surprising amount of creatures, just because there are a lot of small utility dudes running around, you know, like Edric and all that shit. But the cost is just so high, I'm really having a hard time being sold on this guy.
Me personally, I don't really use him much either, and I have a tendency to play a lot of like red and sometimes with a splash of black. But the thing for me is, like, just like Willie said, it's the cost. And granted, there are a lot of generals out there that this guy could easily pick off by giving the -2/-2 ability. But there's not enough generals in my group or area where it's worth it. And the other abilities are just not worth it for the cost. So if I were going to say, and I'd have to say he's actually pretty bad. I mean, in comparison. I mean, I'm pretty sure he's probably good in, like, limited or some other format, but just not here. He's dealing with cards that are way too big for his particular reach. And since we basically just talked about him, we're going to just go into the Golgari Guildmage too. So with the Golgari Guildmage, like granted, the ability to return target creature card from your graveyard to your hand is one thing. But the main problem I've got with him is because he's got a 5-mana cost. Now, with the Rakdos guy, like we just talked about how having like four mana costs in his abilities, a mana ability that costs 4 mana is actually kind of steep. And the Golgari is going in the exact wrong direction by going higher with the plus with 5 mana. So it's like 4 and a green or 4 and a black, and one of them, all it gets you is a +1 counter, which is okay, but still, for 5 mana, I should be getting more than just one +1 counter. I should be getting at least like a good like 2, maybe 3, because that just doesn't it just feels like way too much for so little effort.
Yeah, I totally agree on the Golgari Guildmage, especially when it comes to the +1/+1 counter. That's they were trying to get symmetry with it by doing that, making it 5, but it's just bad. And sacrificing a creature to put a creature in your hand from the graveyard is for 5 is not that impressive. I mean, Eternal Witness gets any card back for much cheaper, and you can do fun things with Eternal Witness instead of playing this guy. You know what I mean? Yeah, Golgari Guildmage is just a huge letdown when he could be really good. His abilities are interesting, at least, and if they were cheaper or a little bit stronger, it could be a really good card.
Right now, I'm trying to make this work in my Skullbriar deck, a deck I built exclusively just so I could play Golgari a few months before Gatecrash comes out. And I'm really not getting a lot of utility out of this. I thought it would be a good sac outlet, but the cost is so high, I need that mana to do other stuff. Not just to protect Skullbriar and put him back in the command zone. The 1-1 counter can add up over time, but again, that's just such a high cost, I really don't see him being playable outside of decks that are just hyper mana ramp centric, I guess.
I mean, the return a creature from your graveyard to your hand is okay, but it wouldn't even work in a Skullbriar deck, because if Skullbriar ended up in your graveyard, you're not using that to knock all of his counters off.
Well, no, you would sacrifice the Skullbriar to put him to command zone. And just use him as a sac outlet, primarily, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but then you'd have to find a way to get Skullbriar back onto the field just so you can pay 5 mana to blow him up?
No, you send Skullbriar from the field to the command zone as a normal sac outlet.
Okay.
And then you get a creature from your graveyard to your hand as a bonus for that. So you have your commander back in your command zone, ready to play. And then you have a bonus card that you got back from your graveyard to your hand.
So what you're saying is that you would be willing to pay, what would this be then? Right, just in that particular instance, let's say, how much is Skullbriar? 2?
Yeah.
It's like a green and a black, right?
Yeah, and it'll be 4 to recast after that.
So what you're saying is you're willing to pay 8 colorless, double black, and a green to get a creature card from your graveyard to your hand.
But no, I'm not. That's why I'm saying he's bad.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Even in a Skullbriar deck, it's like that's a bad outlet. And it's like even on the other side, like if Skullbriar was in the graveyard, you wouldn't want to use this ability to bring Skullbriar out the graveyard because he'll go into your hand.
Yeah.
Because like the only only effect on this thing that Scobari would even want is the plus one counter.
Yes, that's that's what I tried to do with it, but it turns out it's a bad card for that build.
Yeah.
Like, I get sidetracked, and when the wife walks in and she's got babies screaming in the background, I kind of lost track of what actually was being said.
Yeah.
Victor me!
Ah, sometimes I wish I could, Calvin, but you're just so delicious.
Chocolate.
All right. We're going to get off this silly Golgari Guildmage thing, and we're going to go straight into the Izzet Guildmage. This guy is actually a really neat utility guy that I've been playing in my aforementioned Draco Genius deck. In that deck, I'm running a lot of smaller utility instants, like your Lightning Bolt, Brainstorm, and some of the sorceries like Ponder, too. And being able to double on that is surprisingly useful, especially when you can do it multiple times. Because if you have the mana for it, you can copy an effect multiple times and just bolt the shit out of stuff.
So when the copy comes into play, does that count as casting it as well?
No. You put the copy on the stack, but the spell isn't cast.
Damn it.
You can actually go instant or infinite with it, too, with like arcane spells if you do it right. So, yeah, Izzet Guildmage is pretty sweet. Not my favorite, but probably my second favorite of all the old Guildmages, I'd say.
Yeah, and he's got like these sweet binocular glasses.
Yeah, he definitely looks the part, too, so that's important.
Dude, I want to know what that blue dust is he has. It's like he's just smoking science.
Who doesn't? Yeah. He's that's Walter White after he joins up on Ravnica, right? You know, I will mention also the Izzet Guildmage is one of the few Guildmages where they got the price right. Like, if that was like 4 or 5, like, it would get farther and farther away from actually being playable, you know what I mean? Like, 3 is perfect for the ability.
And the good thing for it is, like, in I can see it being used in multiple formats with spells that have a converted mana cost of 2 or less. But, like, it's one of the things where I could see the Izzet Guildmage being used in, like, decks that have Lightning Bolt effects and Shock effects. But the one thing I'd have to actually say that I find interesting about him is that it gives you a reason to play low mana cost stuff in Commander. I mean, this outside of the Scepter, Isochron Scepter, is basically...
Isochron Scepter, yeah.
The Isochron Scepter, like, those are, like, basically two of the only cards I can think of that would be worth kind of using in EDH for if you're playing, like, low-cost spells.
Actually, what I find a lot of the time is that I think it was the Spellbinder. Whenever you hit someone, you get to copy the instant that you exiled with it. I find a lot of times I prefer having a lot of the cheaper stuff like your Lightning Bolt and your Brainstorm under those instead of risking a really big instant that I'm trying to recur because red and blue have the best spell recursion abilities. So you build like your Isochron package, your Spellbinder package with this, and then you slap the Izzet Guildmage in there, and then you just get value out the chain.
Alright, so, yeah, with the Azorius Guildmage, like I was saying, this is one of my favorite out of the actual, like, 5 that we have on the list here. My favorite is actually the Selesnya one, but we'll get to that one in a moment. With the Azorius Guildmage, what I actually really like about it is that it has a built-in counter-target activated ability on it. And granted, it's 2 colors and a blue, so it's kind of like cancel, but the main thing I actually enjoy about this is I personally don't really like counter spells myself. And the main reason I never really liked counter spells is because I always end up finding myself holding on to them. And anyone that, like, kind of knows how I play and knows me, counter spells have always been, like, my weaker point. I hate having, like, a counter magic or a counter spell in my hand and, oh, look, he's playing his general. Should I counter that? I've only got one. And people here. Maybe I should have on. You know what? I'm going to do it. And then I counter it. And the next thing I know, like, the next player plays, like, a Wrath of God. And I'm like, oh, all my tokens are gone. But with this particular thing, it's kind of a nice way of having something there where I can kind of be like, you know what? As long as I've got mana, I can make that choice. And I don't lose the card if I counter the activated ability.
Yeah, and there's a surprising amount of creatures that do activated ability stuff. It seems like Enter the Battlefield effects are always the ones that we talk about because they're basically spells grafted onto the creatures. But what I noticed when someone started playing Nvala in my meta was that having your activated abilities messed with fucking sucks. And that was just the creatures. Azorius Guildmage can shut down the Maze of If, shuts down the artifacts. She does everything except get past Spellskite. Oh, fucking God. You ever try activating this thing in response to something and then just having them go, lol, no bro, Spellskite bro?
Yeah.
And then you try and counter the spell Skype, but then they just go, bro, Phyrexian mana.
Hmm. Does that work, though?
Yeah, because it's targeting the activated ability, but then you're redirecting it to the activated ability of the spell Skype. I don't even know how that works, but...
I'm not sure, because it changes it to the target to the spell Skype, so I don't actually think that works, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm not very good with rules.
I had someone do it to me at the open series, so...
Bastards, I would call judges. Yeah, I agree. Azori's Guild Mage is, I think it's the best of the original 10, and, I mean, I'm pretty sure I've seen all the new ones. I think this one's still better than them, too. It's just, it's one of the few Guild Mages where, like, it's one of the best blue-white creatures in general, in my opinion. Tapping a creature for 3 is not something that's easy to come by. Countering an activated ability over and over again is not something easy to come by either. So it's one of the few Guild Mages where it's not like, you know, most of them are just like, here's some abilities our colors have, and you can pay them to use them. It's kind of cool. And then you get the Azori's Guild Mage where it's like, oh, by the way, this card's amazing. You know what I mean? So for me, Guild Mages, or the Azori's Guild Mage is by far the best Guild Mage and easily my favorite. And I mean, I don't think any of them are auto-includes except for the Azori's Guild Mage, honestly.
Yeah, another thing I like is that her two abilities actually kind of interact with each other in a nice way. What I found with playing Detain cards recently is that usually if you're targeting something with an activated ability to shut it off, they activate it in response. She can actually try and tap down a tap-activate-something creature, and then can try and use the activation, but then you just counter that in response. So they get no activations, and you can keep that creature tapped down as long as you have the mana to pay for it.
And that's one of the good things about her. And the thing is, it's not just creatures. Like, the main thing I enjoy the most about her is the fact that she goes after, like, artifacts. And she can shut down, like,
fast mana?
Planeswalkers.
She can shut, like, then especially planeswalkers. Like, you can see someone get to a point where they have, like, because since planeswalkers are sorcery speed, you can honestly say, like, your turn is not going to have that planeswalker go off. I don't give a damn how big your Jace Demonscope Disloyalty count is. It's never happening. As long as I have this, you are not exiling shit. You're not doing nothing.
Oh, that's something I hadn't actually considered before. You're right. And in that case, she does become extremely good. Now they do get the loyalty counts because that's part of the cost. Mm-hmm. But being able to...
It can keep ticking up, or you can tick it down, or you can do what you want, but the activated ability is not happening.
Exactly. And being able to stop a Venser emblem or an Elspeth emblem from going off, oh, that's just money in the bank.
Yeah, dude. That's what I'm saying. Like, this, there's never been a time where I was like, oh, this card sucks. Like, no, I put it in every fucking blue-white deck I ever build. It always comes in handy. People always underestimate it. Yeah, like, oh, I play Karn. I exile your thing. Ho-ho, good game. Like, I just counter your Karn. You're dumb. Let's keep playing now. You know what I mean? So, countering the emblems is awesome, too, I gotta say.
Question. Is anyone oddly aroused by the fact that we have a blue-skinned alien with a tube top on?
No, I've always kind of found it a little, what is that, Fifth Element-y?
Yeah.
Kind of like that scene where the chick is on there singing, and you're kind of like, I'm not really sure if I should be turned on or disgusted by this, but I'm enjoying both. And you know what? This erection is not going away, so I might as well just, you know, finish myself off here.
Then he, like, sticks his hand into her stomach, and that's kind of gross.
Yeah,
but she is obviously not red on the inside. She is blue all the way.
Yeah, Bruce Willis in a tank top isn't bad either. Calvin, you've got Selesnya Guild Mage.
Alright, so the Selesnya Guild Mage out of these 5 is my personal favorite, but not really because of itself, but because of how it kind of showed me how I became better at the game without knowing. Because with the Selesnya Guild Mage, this has probably nothing. This has nothing really to do with EDH, but it could if you wanted to. The very first time I ever actually saw the Selesnya Guild Mage was when I was playing cubed with a friend. I happened to pass a couple of cards, and I got the Selesnya Guild Mage in a deck and a copy of Skull Clamp.
What was that?
Skull Clamp. So, the thing is that at that time, I had no idea how equipment worked, because it happened to come out before I got a chance to actually find out how it worked. I didn't know what they were. And I had it, and I misread it and misunderstood Skull Clamp and figured I could use an opponent's creatures. Kind of like I can equip my Skull Clamp to your thing. So in the middle of an actual, like, game, I'm trying to put Skull Clamp on my opponent's, like, 1-1 army tokens. And he's like, you can't do that because equipment is a sorcery speed. You can only do it on your guys. So I was like, oh, well, this card is nowhere near as good as I thought it was.
What?
Then I just sat there, and I was like, okay, so what can I do with this? What can I do with this? What can I do?
What can you do with a thing that lets you draw two cards?
And then I looked down and I saw, like, I had the Guild Mage, and I was like, okay, well then fine. How's about I pay 4 mana, I'm going to make a sapling token, and I'm going to use this Skull Clamp and draw 2 cards.
Wait, what just happened here? Did we just discover our first engine? Question mark?
Yeah, and that was the first time it actually had occurred to me. Like, you know what? I actually was good enough at this game to pick a card that I didn't know how to use.
Birth of a Legend, right here. You heard it here first.
It's right in the middle. And then at that point, I was like, okay, well, because I would either be using my mana to make tokens to block with or stall the board out. And then once I got enough tokens for that, any other tokens basically became Skull Clamp fodder. Until eventually my creature's arm got the +1 counters from the Guild Mage so I could be able to pump them up. So that's where I kind of have like a special place in my heart for this particular elf.
The Selesnya Guild Mage is pretty cool. I wouldn't say it's one of my favorites, just because I think there's more interesting cards that kind of do the same thing. But it is one of the few Guild Mages that doesn't require too high of a price for what it does. I think the 4 for a sapling is a pretty decent price. I mean, you're paying about the same for V2 Ghazi, and it doesn't really come much cheaper than that. There's the Jade Mage, which I guess is a little cheaper, but you know, whatever. And then the Anthem effect could be actually pretty cheap if you have enough creatures. So, I mean, the Selesnya Guildmage is at least good. You know, I think green-white just has way too many good cards that usually outshadow it. But it's not like the Rakdos or the Golgari one where you're just, like, looking at it and you're just like, I just don't get it. You know what I mean? It's not just bad. It's a decent card. Yeah, it's no Azorius Guildmage. I mean, it doesn't even come close. But it's still pretty good.
Well, Adam from Daily MTG was on the show a couple times, and I remember one of the secret tech that he shared with us was, in fact, the Selesnya Guildmage. And one of his favorite things to do was to pump out the creature tokens, and people would just forget that this guy does Anthem. He kind of has a mini overrun without the trample, which, if you can pump out the tokens at the rate that token decks do, this guy can make things ridiculous. He's no Kamal Fisakroza, but that 1-1 can still get in the red zone. And as we always advocate here in Commander Zone, it's always good to have those mana dumps for late game when you don't really have that much to do. You know, I've been trying out a lot more mana dumps recently. I have to agree with Andy's original theory. Whoever spends the most mana meaningfully is the one who's going to win. And in a deck that you have green for draw, but white's kind of hungry for it outside of the Mentor of the Meek, this guy will give you value out the wazoo. And you were mentioning the V2 Ghazi guild tree. This guy can do it more than once a turn, even. The Jade Mage does it for cheaper, but she doesn't give you the Anthem of Overrun effect.
Right, yeah.
So, definitely not as good as the Azorius Guildmage, I'll definitely say that. But the Selesnya Guildmage is a very solid Guildmage, and definitely in that upper echelon of the 10, I would feel.
And one of the good things about this particular Guildmage that I have to add in, like, out of the 5 that we have here, it's one of the only ones, like, that can actually win the game on its own, if left alone.
Right,
like the other ones, they require a card or some type of interaction with an opponent or copying some type of spell or something in your graveyard or something to sacrifice. Except for the Azorius Guildmage, who really doesn't give a damn what's there because she can just kind of just, you know, get there on her own if you got enough mana.
Oh, we've got a 20-turn life clock here.
Yeah. But, you know, hey, like, you know, if you're playing blue and white, you're going to be stalling, so you've got plenty of time. That's all blue ever really has is time. Time stretches and time warps and all various forms of time manipulation.
Yeah, you're right. That's actually a very important part about the Selesnya Guildmage, is that it's one of the few Guildmages that doesn't need any other resources. All you need is the mana dump, and that's it. And not only that, but you can do it multiple times a turn in response to stuff.
Yep, multiple times a turn, not even just your turn, because these aren't sorcery speed effects, folks. These can be done during your opponent's end step. So if you only have, like, 4 mana open, you can technically have 1/1s with haste.
All right, folks, that about wraps it up for our Retrocycle review. Any last thoughts?
Rakdos Guild sucks.
Yeah, even the new guild mage sucks. They never get good guild mages. But, yeah, my final thought, Azorius guild mage is awesome. That's pretty much that's all I always come back to.
Blue Alien 2 tops. They get there.
Woo.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take this into the outro. But before I do, I just want to say, real quick, we're going to go ahead and list off our rankings for the guild mages. Calvin, go.
Number one is Azorius. The second one is the Zalesnia. Right after that, we have the Izzet, then there's Golgari and Rakdos sitting on the bottom.
All right, and you know what? I'm just going to echo Calvin because he just listed mine off verbatim. Cassidy.
Yep, me too. That was nice and quick. There we go.
Unlike last week, where we had a shitstorm over Sisters of Stone Death versus Crows of the Conglave, this one's pretty much unanimous, folks. Okay, if you have your own ranking, I would love to see those, because if there's one person that deviates from this list, I would be surprised. Go ahead and email us or leave a comment down below. And I think this qualifies under the 140 characters, so go ahead and send that on Twitter. All right, boys, we're going to go ahead straight to the outro. All right, so that was Commander Cast Season 9, Episode 2. And I think this was, after the Deadwood that we had last week, I think this is a pretty resounding success.
Success. Keywords.
Yes.
Suck it.
There we go. You know what? I'm going to even use that as a new word bite. This was pretty successful, and I'd like to thank my off-color cast co-host for that. I think they were a huge part of that.
Aw. He said huge. He's talking about me. And by that, I mean my penis.
Like we said, ninjas and dicks. That's what it all comes down to when off-color cast and commander cast come together.
That might be our new tagline.
Yep. Ninjas and dicks.
Calvin, if people want to reach you, how can they do that?
Hey, everybody, this is Calvin, also known as Captain Resident for internet. And if you're looking for me, you can always find me on Twitter at Captain Resident, or you can go to Gmail, CaptainResident@gmail.com. You can also go to Facebook, where you can find us on the Off Color Cast Facebook page or Facebook group. If you're not using those kind of things, you can also go over to Google Plus. But if you end up at Google Plus, let me warn you right now, chances are you're going to feel what it seems like to be covered in dust and dead, because we're not going to respond and we pay no attention to that website whatsoever. It's actually completely 100% pointless, aside from the fact that we actually like doing this particular point where I like to talk shit about it. Any other places you can find us? You can find us also on offcolorcast.com, because that's where our show goes off at. That's our main website. You can also find good commander stuff over there, and every once in a while there might be something of interest there. Not really sure what. I'm trying to figure out something interesting to do when we actually do come back from our break, which is already down. Because it's season 2. This is episode 2 of this, and we should be back already.
Yeah, I mean, I write for TCG Player, podcast over with Calvin and Christian on Off Color Cast. Thanks for having us on, William. Thanks for keeping the show alive, because, Andy asked everyone else and no one else. Even us, we were like, nah, we're good. So someone had to do it.
Well, thank you for making it easy to make fun of our decks.
Like, I really kind of wanted to bring Commander Cast back, but it was more like I knew I couldn't handle it. I don't have the time for it. Had I been a single man, I would have done it.
Yeah, but if you were single, you wouldn't be playing EDH. You'd be out trolling for pussy.
If I was single, I'd still be, playing EDH. I'd just be like, hey, baby.
Be playing EDH with pussy on him. That's how good he is.
Yeah, pussy speed.
Okay, Cassidy. If people want to reach you, where can they do that?
Oh, yeah, right. I'm at Roger Wrong on Twitter. I have a new email address that I haven't really announced, so I'll go ahead and do it now. It's badstackstcgplayer@gmail.com, so people can email me there for my TCG Player article, but it's just general gaming crap. And I'm on Facebook, too. I don't really do that too much anymore, but feel free. That's it, though.
And I'm William, a.k.a. Blue Ram. I've taken over the Twitter and Gmail accounts, so go ahead and hit me up at commandercast@gmail.com or on Twitter @commandercast. You can also leave me comments on the site. I appreciate the feedback. And you know what? We're recording this a couple of weeks ahead of time, so until like episode 4 or so, I'm not going to be able to hear any of the hater vision. So, can't touch this. Calvin dropping down the beats. Okay, I'm going to end it right here, guys. Thank you for coming out. Thanks to Judd for manning the Commander Cast Facebook. with special honors to Andrew, who's helped us a ton in the past. He's got a new social media job. Great for him. I'd love to have him back sometime, main stuff. Awesome people. Carson for managing our YouTube channel and for putting out some real sweet game videos, including the game, the four-way, where we got to watch Breon one-shot someone without using her own creatures. Fantastic stuff. And finally, Connor for listening through the episode beforehand. Thanks a ton. I cannot be doing this on my own. And finally, thank you to all the awesome volunteers at CommanderCast, to everyone who stayed on with me through the departure that was Andy. That's just absolute typhoon. It's been rough, and I know this is coming to you all a week late, but you know what? That's life. But you know what? We're back, baby. We're better than ever. And as Andy would say, and with much enthusiasm, let's get it! I'm a casual competitive player who likes to optimize his decks, but I don't go all out to get uber-expensive cards for them. I suck at talking good, but here I'm pretty... Okay, hold on, I'm going to start that over again.
I think also you used last week notes, because this is episode 2, right? Recorded on the 16th.
Oh, yeah. The fuck!
I wasn't going to say anything, because I figured you could just go back and fix it and shit, but yeah.
No, I'm just going to start over whole cloth. Fuck!
I was like, wait a second, this is episode 1? I was like, yeah, okay, sure, why not? Like, right, I could have said we recorded last week, but hey, yeah. If you want to put, if your first episode is the one where you have off color cast on, like, you know, that's your thing.
Yeah.
No, we have to go back in the DeLorean. Let's go now! Get to the chopper! Fuck. Alright, I'm going to start over again.
And I'm going to meet so I don't die last.
That's why I got you guys on.
Hold on a quick second.
All right.
You, shut up.
Yeah, that's fine.
Ah!
The baby's attacking back.
Okay, no, I don't have time to play. Shut up.
Managast.com.